CC, this is, I'm happy to tell you, this lunch sold out faster than any other lunch we've had here before, and that included Chris Patten and Anson Chan. So just a couple of matters of housekeeping first. Can I all ask you please to remember to switch your mobile phones back on when you leave? And also, please, the books that we have here are already signed. So Michael will not be doing a signing after lunch. So no book signing, please. Before we start, just a couple more items of housekeeping. On the 1st of June, we have Jerome Cohen. Is that right, Jake, or is it Jerry?
Don't know, Anna. Let's hold on, I'll ask.
Yeah, you got it right.
Okay, Jerome Cohen talking about improving China's soft power and America's, apparently. And then on the 2nd, we have 2nd of June, we have Mark O'Neill talking about the biggest NGO in the Chinese world. And many of you will know Mark for his wonderful writing on China over the years in the SCMP. So I hope you've all had a nice lunch. Michael will speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have questions leading up to a fairly prompt end around 2 o'clock. So what we'll do is pass the microphone around, and you can put your questions to him. So without any more delay, let's introduce Michael, who's going to be talking about traveling on television.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you all. I'm really delighted to be here at the best FCC in the world. Much improved since I was last here. The building seems very different. Anyway, very nice to be with you all. I'm always conscious when I come to an event like this that you know far more about the world, most of you, than I do. Even though I have traveled a lot, we tend to travel rather fast and not notice things in depth as we go along. So please excuse me if I say things that are crassly obvious to you. But what I thought I would do just in the 20 minutes, sort of introductory 20 minutes, is kind of think about, because it helps me to sort this out, why I ended up doing travel programs. In fact, doing 7 series of travel programs between 1988 and 2000, and wherever we are now, 10. Because it wasn't my intention, and not that I had any particular game plan, but it did take me rather by surprise, and I thought I'd go back to how it began, how I stepped out of being a writer and writing comedy and ended up thoroughly enjoying traveling the world and making these series of programs, because it was really a series of accidents. Anyway, I'll go back to a day in 1987. And I just finished making a film called A Fish Called Wanda. And I'll tell John, people remember it, he'll be pleased. It was a sort of limbo, because that was a terrific film. It was a great script. Although I should add a caveat there, because some of you may possibly read my diaries, and in the second volume of diaries is set in the 1980s. There's one entry, which is about 1985, 86, where John has given me the script of A Fish Called Wanda, with a view to my sort of giving him some advice on stammering and how stammerers work. My father had a stammer and all that. And I write in my diary that it's just, how do I tell John that the script is just not funny? That's the brilliant thing about diaries. You write things and, you know, which later on embarrass you, but that's the way diaries are. You felt like that on that day. And of course, the great thing about A Fish Called Wanda, which I'm really not here to discuss, is that it turned out to be very funny because it played against the norms. Kevin Klein played the sort of Basil Fawlty, high-energy character, leaving John to play this rather nice kind of Cary Grant leading man romantic. And I thought it showed something that John hadn't done before. And Kevin was just brilliant. I mean, he's a total, awful, sadist psychopath. And he made him terribly funny, and that's just brilliant. So if there's any Oscar for people who make psychopaths really funny, I think Kevin should have got it. Anyway, I'd finished Fish Called Wanda, and a number of films I'd made during the 1980s, including A Private Function, an Alan Bennett script, and working with Terry Gilliam on Time Bandits and Brazil, a Monty Python movie, Meaning of Life. And suddenly, there were no particularly good or interesting scripts around. And I was rung up by someone from the BBC in rather sort of conspiratorial circumstances. I don't know quite why, but it was the head of documentary, said, can we talk? And I said, yes, as you do on the phone, you know. Rather obvious, I would have thought. No, not on the phone. I can't talk on the phone. I must come to your house. All right, come to the house. I think I'm now looking back, you know, I think it was just getting him out of the BBC. He just couldn't bear being in television centre. And I do better coffee. And anyway, he came round and said, we've got this idea. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be hard. It's never been done before. But you have all the qualities that could make this work. You've got the wit. You've got the physical presence, the charisma, the charm, the humour, the intellectual probity. It just went on and on and on. And by the end of it said, well, so what do you think? Are you interested? And I said, yes, absolutely. Thank you. Just the prospect of travelling around the world on the BBC's money appealed to me. But also he had built me up into something of, someone who was clearly extra special and cut out for this kind of programme. About 3 weeks, 4 weeks into the actual eventual programme, we were holed up in Madras, now Chennai, waiting for a boat to take us across to Singapore. And we'd had a few beers, and the director rather shamefacedly confessed to me that I was the fifth person they'd asked to do it. So BBC British Bullshit Corporation lived up to its name. But anyway, they did ask me, and I was glad I'd said yes. And the problem then was really what kind of program it was going to be. They had very little idea other than that I would be the traveler. There would be a camera there all the time, following my every move. And the night before we set off, I suddenly woke up in complete panic, because I thought, there is no script here. I don't know what I'm going to be saying. I mean, how are we going to fill, you know, whatever it is? We've got six hour-long episodes to fill, traveling around the world, not taking any plane flights, trying to do it faster than, you know, Phileas Fogg in the Jules Verne, or emulate what Phileas Fogg did in the Jules Verne story. And that's all. It's an idea, but it's got no real basis. And just in retrospect, I don't think the BBC would probably do something like that nowadays. They prepare the ground much more. So it was a bit of a thrill when we started. There were one or two things that we had to work out. One was, who was I going to be? What sort of character? Was I going to be me? No, surely not. I'm an actor and all that. So was I going to try and be Phileas Fogg's, reincarnation? And I think in the first two or three programs of Around the World in 80 Days, I was trying to play this character, because that's what I am, an actor, and trying to sort of be the English buffer abroad, and sort of the voice and the attitudes and all that were all a sort of me playing a character. And this all changed. Everything I'm talking about now really reflects on why we ended up doing so many programs afterwards, because this was really just a one-off. It changed on the third episode, what turned out to be the third episode of Around the World in 80 Days, which happened to be a Dow journey from Dubai to Bombay. Things had gone wrong in Saudi Arabia. We were supposed to get a boat which was going to take us from Jeddah around to Oman, where a Dow had been booked to take me, as it were, across to Bombay, and they'd been briefed as to what was going to happen. But the boat in Jeddah never turned up. We sort of asked, and they said, it's coming tomorrow from the north. And the next day said, been delayed. It's coming tomorrow. They'd definitely be in port tomorrow. And we were losing days, and we couldn't afford to hemorrhage days on something we were trying to do around the world in 80 days. Eventually, on the third day, they admitted it. No, it won't ever come. It's burnt out. What? It's totally burnt out. There'd been an explosion on board. It's burnt out in a port just to the north. Oh, thanks very much. So we had to rearrange very, very quickly. And the director and myself got permission to drive across Saudi Arabia to Dubai, where we were. There tend to be more dhows going, and we'd have to get a fresh dhow there. The reason the crew were able to fly was that that was fine. They got to Dubai and tried to organize the dhow. I was not allowed to fly, so as I say, we got permission to drive across Saudi Arabia, provided we took no photos along the way. Not there was a lot to take photos of, but anyway, we got across there and ended up in Dubai. And the whole game plan had changed. We've got a dial that they didn't know what we were doing. There were 18 very obliging, nice, friendly Gujarati fishermen, a captain who spoke a little bit of English, and they were going to be taking us across to Bombay, and it was going to take 6 days, possibly 7 days, maybe even 8 days. And in the end, we just had to go at their pace. And I got on that boat, I look at the episode, and there I am, still in Phileas Fogg, British buffer role. Oh, here we go, oh, I'm getting on board and all that. I totally changed by the end, and the reason was that this dhow journey was so extraordinary and such a sort of leveler that by the end, when I got off that dhow, I was just being myself. The reason were really that as I say, all our technology, all our kit, all our gear, all that stuff we had with us didn't matter a damn, because it was the dhow and its own technology was going to get us there, and its technology was very basic. There was no GPS, there were no sat phones at that time. We were with these fishermen for as long as it took to get to Bombay, and it took a very long time because they only moved about 4 knots, and the engine broke at one point, and as the captain said, he said, it's the rubber band, he said, and it was a sort of rubber band, quite a strong rubber band, but obviously not strong enough, so there was a lot of, they had to get that going, and Every day they would get out an old sextant and take the position, our position, and note it down. It was really very, very relaxing and rather lovely, but difficult for the director, who was just panicking about the days it was going to take. And also our sound recordist. I love sound recordists. They always, I don't know why, they know all the airline timetables in the world. So we'd be lying on the dhow, and a plane would go over, and he'd say, that's the British Airways 4:30 flight. That'll be in Bombay in 2 hours. We've got another 4 days. So I said, relax, calm, chill out. Anyway, one particular event happened, which also shaped the future pattern of the series. And I'll just tell you very quickly, but it was, I became ill, got some gut ache thing, and what happened was, in the dhow, we all slept together on deck. I mean, there was no below decks or anything like that. We slept on these packages of nuts and things which the boat was taking to Bombay. And the crew got rather sort of disillusioned with us because we went to bed rather early. And we were in bed by about 8:30 because there wasn't a lot else to do. But this particular night, I had to get up about 10 o'clock because I felt awful and had to use the loo. And The toilet on the boat, well, it wasn't actually on the boat. It was a box slung off the back of the boat, roped together, and you just got into this box. A very awkward thing to do for people who have been used to using the toilet in private. I didn't know how to work it. First time, I sat the wrong way around. Someone had to point out, no, it's got to align it where the hole is and all that. So anyway, we worked it all out, but it wasn't the sort of place you wanted to go to in the middle of the night. Up I get. And, of course, the crew are there, and they see me get up, and they say, Michael, he's calling Michael, come and join us. Great. They thought, obviously, he's a sport. Even though the crew are dullards, he's a sport. And I'd say, no, I'm just going to. So I went to the loo and then went back, and they were all rather disappointed. And it was one of those nights when it was a reoccurring problem. And about 3 hours later, I got up again, holding on to my sort of piece of British toilet paper, a roll of British toilet paper, like sort of hymn sheet, staggering off across the boxes. Michael, hey, come here, come join us. No, I don't, I'm feeling too good. Just going to, okay. Great disappointment. Anyway, the third time I woke up, this was about 4 a.m., they were still there because they had to wait up all night just to make sure that mines from the latest Gulf War didn't hit the side of the dhow and things like that. So they were all up, and they were up at 4 a.m. And this time they were ready for me, and I got up, and this was the worst. I felt truly awful. The last sort of last particles of whatever was in my stomach were going to come up, and I staggered across, and they say, Michael, hey, come over here. We have made you a curry. And so... Anyway, the next morning, I felt pretty miserable, and the director decided to film a piece of me confessing to how miserable I felt. And I sat there in bed and did this rather pathetic piece about how awful you feel, and I love dhows and it's wonderful, but when things get ill, when things get bad and you feel ill, all you want to do is just be at home or sit in a chair or something like that. Anyway, I whinged on for about sort of a minute. Anyway, skip on to when the series came out. It turned out that this was one of the most popular moments in the entire series, something that would never normally be done on television. Most reporters, I mean, you all know, you don't stand in front of the camera and say, I don't feel very well. Oh, dear, I don't want to be here in Afghanistan. I've got a tummy ache and Veruca's not very good today. You don't do that sort of thing. You know, it's not the macho stuff. But they kept it in, and it really worked. And people began to say to me, oh, we loved that program where you were really ill. And it was like 30 seconds of a program lasting, 50 minutes. But the other thing that was important about that program was that I realized that our lives and our, well, lives actually, yes, that's not exaggerating. Certainly the physical success of the journey we were making depended on these Gujarati sailors who had nothing. They were, you know, among the poorest people on earth. And they looked after us. We depended on them to get us there without, you know, if storms blew up, we would depend on them, their navigation to get us through. And a really rather good relationship grew up between us over those 7 days. I've never ever, in all the travels I've done since then, ever had a relationship quite like that. It was almost like it existed in a capsule away from the rest of the world. And we got on and we learned, I learned some of their language, and they made us made us some wonderful curries. We looked at the map and talked about where I was going and all that. And when, it actually took 8 days to get to Bombay. And when we left the boat, they sort of lined up to say hello. And there was an old guy called Kasim, who was the oldest of them all. And he just, instead of just saying hello, he just grabbed me and gave me a terrific sort of bear hug. And it was really, really touching. I was terribly moved, you know, before I left the boat. And as I say, by the time I left that boat, I didn't have to be Phileas Fogg. I didn't have to be this sort of created character. It was just me. And I think that was the most significant moment in all the Around the World in 80 Days. And became really very significant in the way we made programs after that. But anyway, we carried on. And it turned out also that what didn't work on Around the World in 80 Days were the set-up interviews. And we had one or two interviews. The director had got rather... somewhere in Greece, and a man who would be able to tell us exactly what's going on in Greece. You need them now, don't you? But it'd be a minister, quite a high-up minister, and I didn't know quite what to tell him, and he didn't know quite what I was doing. So he would talk on for about 40 minutes. And I didn't like to say, look, we're only going to use 40 seconds of this. So I just nodded away. Then we do a lot of interviews with ship's captains. Whenever we got on a boat, which we did frequently, the director would say, go and talk to the captain. I said, what about? Just ask him where we are. So I would go up onto the bridge, and there would be the captain, and they would say, can Michael do a little talk with you? Yes, fine. So, well, you look out, it's a completely empty sea. So, where are we? He'd say, we are 20 north, 20, 50 east. Oh, God, wow. How many days shall we get there? Oh, well, it's about maybe 2 days. Great. And by then, what do you say? Do you know, how long have you been captain? Oh, I've been captain for 19 years. 19 years. 19 years. Yeah, 19 years. Wow. Not 20. No, 19. Just sure to be 20 next year. 20 next year, yeah. Unfortunately, there'd be some guy. There was a wonderful, wonderful Saudi captain, marvellous, on a boat which has since actually sunk with a lot of people on board. And he suddenly said, you know, I said, well, do you sort of get many Brits coming through? He said, no, not. But do you ever visit England? He said, no, but I love Liverpool. I said, you've not been there. No, but I love Liverpool, the team, the football team. Really? Oh, I love Liverpool. He immediately gave me a rundown of Liverpool's results over the last 4 years. And great, we had something to talk about. But generally speaking, these interviews didn't really work. What did work? Well, when things went wrong, not just with my stomach, but also we did a rather hit and miss sequence of me with a little microphone on, walking outside the Taj Hotel near the Gate of India. And I was just sort of going to meet various people. Michael, just walk, and if you see some people, just talk to them. The first man who came up to me said, "Hello, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from London." He said, "You want a girl?" No. "You want girly men?" No, girly men. Girly men. I do men. A girl. Donkey. No. This was all on the microphone. Just brilliant. You know, sort of much more interesting than talking to the captain. Anyway, I settled for the donkey. Donkey Quixote. And there was another wonderful moment in India where we were just walking down the street and there was somebody shaving, a street barber. And the director said, "This would be great. Go on, Michael, have a shave." I said, "Well, I've just shaved this morning." No, it'd just look good. So I sat down and I must say, the people on the street gathered around, looking rather alarmed, but, quite interested. I don't think any sort of non-Indian would do something like that, but it was great. So I sat down, and it was very jolly, and the people were around and all that, and the man was shaving me very, very carefully. It was actually a very, very good shave. And his sort of fingers were touching my chin and my cheeks as he went round. I suddenly looked into his eyes, and I realized why they were all looking at me in some consternation, that he was blind. And the razor was going just down here to the bit where if you cut it, you're dead in probably 10 seconds or something like that. So I just riveted to the spot. Anyway, it worked very well. It was a very nice sequence. And I suppose that the typical of the misadventures on that particular adventure that worked very well was our return to London. We got back to London on the last day, 79 days and 7 hours after leaving after some extraordinary adventures. We did get to London. We were on time. We just had a few hours to get to the Reform Club. And we got there, and there was the Reform Club in sight. And we walk up the steps, knock on the door, said, "We're back." And they said, "You can't come in. We've got a function on today. But we just want to come on through the door." Just going, "No, I'm terribly sorry. Someone's booked already. I have a booking for 4:15. That was it. "So what do you do?" Well, we had somebody suggested we should go. A director who's in London said, "We can go to the BBC and get a room that looks like the Reform Club." And I was pretty fed up, having been away for so long. We haven't gone through these adventures. I said, "No, we've got to show it like it is." So we did I did my final piece to camera outside the Reform Club, saying, "Here we are. It's nearly 80 days. We're back, but they won't let us in. So this is the end of the journey." And that was an enormous success. People remembered that ending much better than us just going in through the door. And in particular, sort of Americans get very, very, can't understand this at all. And they say to you, what kind of place is it that just wouldn't let you in after all you've done, all you've been through and all that? I said, "Well, that's what clubs are like. They're not there to let people in. They're to keep people out. They were doing exactly what they normally do." So that was that. And the other thing that about the return, which also I thought was interesting, was that nobody really wanted to talk about being around the world in 80 days. You are a total outcast if that's what you've just done. We got off the boat at Felixstowe, and they'd arranged a container truck was going to take me to Felixstowe station. We were going to get a train down to London. And they said, they got the driver, "Talk to the driver a bit about what you've done. Tell him what you've done. Tell him where you've been." So I sat in this truck, and the cameraman was there with me, and it was a bit like talking to the captain, "Oh, well, I'm glad to be back. Whew." And he just drove on. I'm glad to be back after so long. He's just driving. "Oh, what a long time I've been away." He said, "It took me 3 hours to get to work this morning. You try coming down from Scunthorpe. I've got that Newark bypass all blocked up and all that." And I realised that, I'd say I've been around the world, it didn't really matter to him at all, nor indeed to anybody else. You say, at parties, we came back in December, and a lot of Christmas parties, and people say, "So what have you been doing?" "Well, I've just been around the world." I said, "Oh, God, I bet it was easier than getting past Bletchley in the morning, Russia. I mean, the 4 trains cancelled this morning, 3 yesterday. I'm thinking of taking up the car." And you just... it's same with the family, actually, I'm afraid. It wasn't if my family were waiting for me. "Oh, Dad, here you are," and all that. They were sort of just rather puzzled that I was back at home. Anyway, all these things are rather interesting, I think, and I'm very much in favour of a guidebook. Came out about 10 years ago, which had a whole section on coming back home, how to deal with coming back and telling people where you've been. Don't expect that they're going to be in the slightest bit interested, which is very true. Anyway, that was Around the World in 80 Days. So the next thing was, when the programme went out, the BBC had actually, we'd shot so much that they gave us 7 programmes instead of 6. And it proved to be a great hit. But the episode which really launched it was the episode on the Dow. Before that, going on the Orient Express, going through Greece, all that sort of thing, the pyramids. People had kind of seen that before. But once we got onto the Dow, that was something different from anything anyone had seen before. And I think it was also the fact that I'd changed and I was just being myself. And this is what sort of carried it through to the end. So we had finished the series. It had been successful. We'd done it on our own particular terms. In a 2 years after that, because the book and the series had gone so well, the BBC offered us a second series. I just expected Around the World in 8 Days to be the end of it, and then I would go back to acting and writing and making films, which I did. But the BBC said, no, you know, if you'd like to travel again. So in the second series, we had to look and see, there were certain things we had to deal with. One was, what has Jules Verne written about? Anywhere else we can go? There's, you know, 20,000 Leagues Beneath the Sea, not so good. Journey to the Center of the Earth, logistical problems. And we came up, we looked at the atlas and said, we've been around the center of the earth, why don't we go from the North Pole to the South Pole? I thought, just wonderful. You know, places I've always wanted to go to since I read about explorers when I was a kid growing up in Sheffield. So we decided to do pole to pole. And of course, there was no sort of time constraint that had made 80 days. A lot of people said, without the 80 days thing, without that time constraint, this is not going to work. People just don't want to see you traveling. But we decided we would build in some sort of time constraint where possible. So it would always be phone calls from me to the office saying, I'm in Zambia and we've only got sort of 10 days to get to South Africa to get to the boat to Antarctica. But it was all a little bit contrived. And there were other problems too by then, which was that Around the World in 80 Days had been very popular and sold particularly well in Europe. And I was no longer an anonymous traveler. And this proved problematical. I'll give you a small example. We were starting the journey in coming down from Norway into down through Lapland and then into Estonia. But we were on a boat which goes up to the very very northern part of Norway, and as we do, the director would say, "Michael, just go and talk to a few people. Go and meet a few people," and sometimes a difficult thing to do because people didn't want to meet you and all that. But anyway, I met a man and he was sort of looking rather mournful, as people do up in that latitude, looking out over the boat. And I said, "Oh, hello." And he said, "Hello." "Oh, yeah." I said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, he said, "I'm a lighthouse keeper. I am keeper of the most northern lighthouse in the world." And I said, "Oh, well, that's you're 6 months of the year. It is, you know, we have a bit of light, and 6 months a year it is all dark and gloomy." And so he kind of carried on in this manner for a bit. And I said, "Well, what on earth do you do during the 6 months when it's really dark?" He said, "Oh, we watch your program on the television." And so I realized then that there were going to be problems. In fact, that happened later, just in one of the later series we did, and we were in a little island called Little Diomede, which I think is one of the most remote islands in the world. It's between Alaska and Russia, that little, on the Bering Strait. And there are two islands. One is there's Little Diomede and Greater Diomede. What a wonderful place to be. It's just a rock in the middle of the ocean, and the international dateline goes between the two islands. So the island over to the west has just finished the day that you're about to start. It's very bizarre, really. You know, who won the election? Oh, shoot, we can't tell you. Anyway, we were on this island, and there are about 60 Inuit who live on the island, and despite all the attempts of the Americans to try and get them over to Alaska and give them better housing and schools and all that sort of thing, they've elected to stay on this island, and they have a school there, they've spent a bit of money on it, but basically it's still very much a very remote community. 6 months of the year, it's iced up around there. And we started our first days filming there, and at the end of the day, the Inuit, the elders, had managed to get a sealskin boat to take us across to Alaska, a very sort of romantic way to do the journey. And we finished our filming. I was going down to the boat, and this little group of elders were sort of coming behind me and showed me the boat, and I bowed, and they came very close to me and looked at me very closely, and I thought might be some nose rubbing or something to do. You know, you've got to be ready for all that. And so I was about to say goodbye, and just as I was leaving, the older man came up to me and said, "Aren't you the guy from Monty Python and the Holy Grail?" So satellite television has got everywhere. I must jump on because time for questions. By that time, by the end of Pole to Pole, we'd realized that we could do these travel programs in the style that we kind of developed, which was not long interviews with people from the tourist board or politicians or anything else. It was encounters with people along the way. It was based on accidents that happened being very good, but it was based on me just being myself. And we'd established this through Pole to Pole. Pole to Pole was as successful in terms of audience as Around the World in 80 Days. So after that, suddenly we had this way of approaching travel programs, which really hadn't been done before. I mean, since then, quite a lot of people now do travel programs in that way. But it really hadn't been done before, because before you would have, if you traveled, you would go with David Attenborough television. And he, you know, David knows his stuff. David's an expert. David will show you the world, but he will tell you about it. Or you will have reporters who are reporting from somewhere and telling you just about the political situation there. The idea of an everyman, someone who just has a sense of wonder about the world, going off and doing the travels, was something quite new. And I think we developed it during 80 Days, and sort of it perfected it during Pole to Pole. And though I was then going back to acting and did, in fact, a follow-up film to A Fish Called Wanda called Fierce Creatures in 1994, I realized then what I wanted to do was to see the world. And with my film crew, who became good friends, did terrific work, and we agreed to do one more program, and that would be it. And that was called Full Circle, which we did in 1996. We've since done four more series. So there it is, and that's really the reason why I do these travels, and the reasons, I think, why they work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Now we'll take questions. In the normal manner, please can people identify themselves and put their hands up, and Simon will pass around with the microphone.
Hi, Michael. Nick Thompson, no affiliation. You're saying about accidents, you've done a hell of a lot of traveling, but have you actually had any accidents?
Just escaped by the skin of our teeth. I remember the landing at the North Pole as the nearest thing to disaster. We had flown up there from Canada, and it was in May. We were going to just land at the pole, do a piece to camera. And of course, the pole is not, as you know, it's on the water. This was late in the season. The ice was cracking up. And it's a sort of given that the more dangerous places in the world you are, the older the aircraft, and the older and more dangerous the aircraft, the older the pilots who are flying them. There are people who have been retired a long time ago from civil aviation, and there was this old guy, and we flew 300, 400, 500, 600 miles, about 500 or 600 miles from the pole, and realized there was nothing down below. There was no airstrip we could divert to. When we got there, we found that the ice had sort of broken up, and we were going to have to land on a small moving ice floe. So I said, "But we don't have to." "Oh no, no," he said. "I'll try and get you down." And the last thing you want there is someone who's going to be macho about it. And then he said, trouble is I can't land at the moment, and I can't land till the sun comes out. And I said, in my sort of naive way, oh, don't be silly, I don't mind. It doesn't matter. Nigel, the camera, you don't mind if the sun's out. And he said, no, no, the sun is important, because without the sun, I cannot see if there are ridges on this ice floe I'm going to land on, because if I hit one of those with this plane, we'll just flip over, and that's it, into the sea. Oh, all right. Yeah, we're waiting for the sun. And we circled around, and we came down, and I've really never been quite so terrified in my life. Came down to this floe, nearly got down, and he obviously saw something on the surface, aborted the landing, and up we went again. We circled round, and the second time he came down, aborted the landing again, circled round. And by that time, I was in a sort of state of complete and total fear and panic. And I just said, look, we don't need to do, it doesn't have to be pole to pole, you know. We'll go from Peterborough to the pole or something like that, you know, if you want alliteration. We don't have to die for it. And I remember thinking then, this guy's going to try it again. He's determined to get us down there, and this is a stupid thing to do. And what would I have told my family? You know, what a stupid way to go. And we actually did get down the third time and managed to do our piece and get off. But, I mean, that was the nearest to, I think, something that would have been a major disaster. Otherwise, we had little problems along the way. We had sort of, I remember in Sudan, we had a problem with Basil Powell, who some of you may know, the eminent photographer who has taken lots of pictures for my books and all that, lives on Chung Chau and in Washington. And we were in the car, and we were outside Omdurman, and Basil took a picture outside the window of some women in their lovely sort of long robes crossing a landscape, and someone saw this in the village and got very angry about it and came across and started to asked Basil for the film back, and then Basil didn't quite understand what he'd done wrong. And by that time, someone else had come along. A lot of people standing around with not much else to do apart from create a mob, and they did very, very quickly. And Basil gave them the film that he'd taken. Very craftily, he'd substituted it for something else. So anyway, he gave them the film, but by that time, they were about to start rocking the car. And if our driver had, if his foot had slipped on the accelerator then, I dread to think what would have happened, and off we went. So a little few moments like that. But I wouldn't say any, fortunately, touch wood, so far, any real serious accidents.
Thank you. Next, over here, I think. Simon?
Yes. Andy?
Yeah. Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
Sorry. I've seen just about all of you. You always seem to be able to keep your cool, at least on camera. We've never seen you. Have you ever lost it with the crew or... Or with Basil
in you've got to say what I like. No. Basil's, just quick thing about Basil. The great thing about Basil is we have the luxury of having a stills photographer. No crews ever have that. But we're an independent company. I think it's very, very important that if we're going to go to these remarkable places, we bring back the best record possible on film and stills as well. So Basil's there. Basil wears his hats. He's very keen on hats. So he has this big sort of... a Panama hat, very elegant, which he manages to not squash. And so sometimes when we're filming and I'm in the marketplace and I can't kind of see where the crew are, I always know where they are because there's Basil behind the camera and I can see his hat, so it's very, very important. But there are other times when Basil tends to walk off, he's doing pictures, and the cameraman will be doing a wonderful pan across some Ethiopian market scene, all these faces of people, all that. Suddenly there's a man with a hat in the shot. Oh, great job, Basil! Stop it! So that it would be great Trivial Pursuit thing, see how many times Basil appears in the series in market squares and exotic places. I have lost my cool, and it's usually on something completely petty, like when we arrived at, on 80 Days, when we arrived at Felixstowe, and I had to walk down quite a long gangplank with my bag off the container ship that had brought us there. And I walked all the way down, and I was doing a bit of, oh, yeah. Well, actually, I didn't have to act it. I was exhausted. And we'd had a party the night before to celebrate nearly getting there, so I was hungover as well. Walked all the way down, got to the bottom. The director said, sorry, no, we weren't ready. Can you start? Well, you weren't ready? And this was a new director. The director was in England. So I put my little foot down and stamped, and it's so feeble to do that, and I regret it a great deal. The other thing I've learned from the programs is never actually to complain There's no point complaining about the food, about the heat, about anything else. Because most people just see it on, when it's on camera, they think, you lucky bastard, you're somewhere wonderful. It looks terrific. Well, he's whinging on. So I just bite my lip and try not to complain. But I may look cool on top, but underneath I'm very hot.
Right. Next person.
Francis Moriarty, FCC Board. The obvious question, if you haven't answered it at the beginning and I missed it, what will your next project be?
Well, I'd actually decided after we did New Europe, which was the seventh of these long series, that perhaps that was the time to stay at home for a bit. Part of the reason was that I'd done all this traveling in 20 years, and I didn't really start traveling until I was 45 when we started doing Around the World in 80 Days. And I'd done an awful lot, and there was a terrible danger, I thought, after seven series and 50 episodes, that things would become a bit of a blur. I just, you know, would go off again around the world, and everything would sort of merge into one. And I kind of wanted to sort of reflect on what I've done and just appreciate what I'd seen and follow up. And lots of people who I'd met on the journey sent me emails about this, that, and the other. So I decided that's it. Let's just, stay at home and think about it all. And that's when I was asked, completely out of the blue, to be president of the Royal Geographical Society in London. And part of the reason I accepted that was it's a three-year thing. I said, well, I want to be at home anyway, and I can actually exchange information with people who've traveled, listen to other people's experiences and all that. But then last Christmas, I did begin to get itchy feet again. And the crew are wonderful. We're all in our mid-60s now. And even the cameraman wants to do another program. He keeps ringing up, Michael, what are we going to get? Where are we going next? And I had this idea of going to Brazil, because Brazil is going somewhere I've not been to before, and I think there's going to be a lot of attention given to Brazil once in the next 4 or 5 years, next Olympics and football and just generally, Brazil as a big player in the world economy and all that, and people don't know much about it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought I'd love to go there. So I went to the BBC, and the BBC is a bit different now, I have to say. Say Michael Payne wants to do a series. They say where rather than yes. Fair enough. There are lots of other people doing similar programs now, but they have agreed to doing 3 1-hour programs in Brazil, which will be shot next year. So that's something. But I'm not. I think it's very, very dangerous to just do these things just for the sake of doing them. You've got to really want to do it, and it's hard work, and you've got to be prepared to put in the work. So I'm looking forward to that. But it'll be a journey through one country. But one enormous country with very, very different aspects and a multifaceted place. So that's hopefully 2011 will be in Brazil.
Right, we'll take 3 more questions. So who else would like to ask something?
Hi, Michael.
Hello.
You had a very varied and great career. What's the funniest moment in your memory?
Well, probably, I actually wasn't so funny at the time, but it is funny in reflection, was the fish slapping dance, which I did with John Cleese. And it's just one of those things people ask, you did Monty Python, or what's the funniest thing you did in Monty Python? It'd be impossible to say, except for the fish slapping dance, which is one particular short item, which just involves me and John in sort of long shorts and pith helmets standing beside a lock, canal lock in Teddington, and I just, the music started, oompy doompy doompy doo, and I just got lightly hit John with 2 pilchards on the side of the head. Yes, that's right. It was set up as a traditional English dance, the fish slapping dance, and I slap him. For about a minute or so, John gets, and really did get quite irritated, as he would by someone slapping you with wet pilchards. And then I bow and stop, and John produces this huge fish from behind his back, hits me with it, and I fall into the canal. That's it. It's nothing more than that. The reason why I think it worked particularly well was reason why it wasn't quite so funny at the time, because we sort of improvised it and did a rehearsal. And when we rehearsed, the lock beside which we were going to dance was full. And we were very intensely rehearsing it, John trying out what we'd do, what's funny, is it, how long should I go on, all this sort of thing. And eventually we got it right. So, all right, are you ready? Yeah, okay, we're ready. Okay, action. And as we did it, I realized the lock had emptied. during that time, and there was a 15-foot drop to the water, and I had a pith helmet and heavy boots on, and the music was playing, and I thought, well, do I say, no, sorry, can we wait? And just, it seemed silly to stop it, and we were enjoying doing it, and yet, so when I was hit, instead of just falling straight into the water, it's a 15-foot fall, which I must say is one of the best things I've ever done in my life. If I want something put on my gravestone, something to be remembered for, I would say it's the fall in the fish slapping dance. Straight down, pith helmet, absolute beautiful posture, you know, Olympic gold, I would say. And it was so funny. I fell into the water, and I just heard everybody sort of laughing round about. And I was in the water was pouring into my boots and dragging me down, and nobody had completely forgotten I was in the water. You're like, excuse me, oh, yes, all right, we'll get you out. So that was, yeah, I say, not so funny at the time, but just it's nice to see it now.
Right, over here.
Hi, Phil Baldwin, no affiliation, just a member. Do you have you've been to all these countries and so forth. Have you ever got to one and said, I want to come back. This is a place I'd like to really experience more.
Yes, most of them, actually. I really, you know, I think that's the way I travel. I find the very, very few places in the world I just wouldn't want to go to. In terms of countries, there are places in countries I perhaps wouldn't want to go to. The various sort of rather grim places in northern Russia I wouldn't rush back to for a holiday. But, there are places that appeal for different reasons. I mean, we spent about 3 weeks traveling through Peru, right from the south up to the north, and went out of Peru along the Urubamba River, tributary of the Amazon. I mean, people don't really do that. You get to Machu Picchu, and then you go back to Cuzco. And that was just wonderful. There were so many elements there. I mean, the from Lake Titicaca on across the... the high divide of the Andes, and then Cuzco, which is an absolutely wonderful city, then to Machu Picchu, just one amazing experience after another. And after that, it just became quite tough. The river north out of Machu Picchu, there's a lot of rapids, and we went on the rapids in these very sort of simple basic boats, trusting the guys to get us through, and that was kind of hairy. But I just have fantastic memories, and I went with someone who was a bird spotter. He was supposed to be our guide. He was continually looking up in the air and saying to the cameraman, Nigel, you should get a picture of that. And of course, the camera, as soon as it gets a picture, the bird's gone. But there were many, many aspects to this to the country I liked very much. I wouldn't mind going back there again, just for the sheer amazement of it. But otherwise, there are lots of places. I mean, I actually really enjoyed. Yeah, I know it sounds a bit ordinary. I love going through Australia. We did a journey through there, largely because things happen in Australia unlike anywhere else in the world. A cow race, I remember that. I went to a provincial fair just north of Adelaide, and they said, can Michael take part in some of the events? And there was a wonderful guy doing the sort of commentary. Yeah, we've got somebody here, I don't know, he is Michael something or other from somewhere. Some pom is going to try and enter the cow race. And the cow racing was just, people sat on cows and had to race about 100 yards, and cows don't like to do that. So as soon as you get on the cow, my cow was called, I can't remember, what, Utterly Yours. Utterly Yours. And he would have a running commentary. Michael's not doing too well here. I think this looks like the Valium cow to me. And actually, we came second. About an hour after the one who'd won it, all the other cars never even started. So, things like that. But I like Australia, and I find it's a very it's a country which continually surprises me, just because so little of it is settled, and so the vast outback, which is quite extraordinary. And I'd love to go back and explore more of that.
Right, one more.
I'm Veronica van der Kamp. I can only identify myself as a Hong Kong belonger.
Yeah.
Just one short question. Have you read out your new book aloud yet?
Have I read what?
Have you read out your latest book aloud?
Oh, my latest book. Which is that? Is that my diaries? Have I read
just
it aloud?
Just on the table. Just being on
yes, I know, as an audio book.
You have?
I'm not sure. This is a very technical question. I certainly read out the diaries, which is the latest book I did, but the book that's for sale here, which is a return to Around the World in 80 Days, is that, I think that's probably the one you referring to? No, you look doubtful.
Thick, very thick,
big, thick heavy book. Heavy book.
Yes.
Yes?
Good.
I haven't read the audiobook, full audiobook of my diary.
Okay, then if you
someone
haven't
else
done
has.
It, yeah. Please do.
Please
soon.
Do. Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I will. Yeah, no, somebody. I did read the first lot of diaries.
Yeah,
I think I read the second. Yes, I did. Sorry. This is much confusion because I wasn't really expecting this question. But I did do it because it's actually on one of the airlines. Somebody said they'd heard me reading the diaries. So a much abbreviated version.
Okay, are you going to do it full length?
Will I do it full length? I do full length.
Page one
yes.
To the end.
Okay, I will.
Take please me back. Do. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yes.
Right. Well, I'm sure we'd all like to say a big thank you to Michael for coming along today. And in the usual fashion, we have a couple of gifts for him. But first, I think Chris has.
In light of your comments about clubs are for keeping people out, not letting them in, we decided to let you join ours.
Oh, I say.
The really good news is, as an honorary member, you
honor.
Don't have to pay dues, but you do have to pay your bar bills.
So oh, right. It'll probably be much more than the dues.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's the intention.
Well, that's very, very good. Can I get Basil? And buy Basil a drink. I do that for the rest of my life. I've done it for the last 22 years. Thank you very much. Thank you. That's very, very kind.
And here we have the famous FCC flak jacket, which I'm sure will be useful on your next trip.
Oh, right. Thank you.
And as a member of the team that made Spam an iconic food product, I'm pretty sure it's almost outlawed in the UK, but you'll be glad to hear we have 7 varieties here, including the low-fat version.
Low-fat, oh, that's well. So surely a contradiction in terms, low-fat Spam. You know, it's like having John Cleese without a sense of humour. Yeah, very, very good. Thank you, I'll enjoy that.
Right. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.